When fueling your wild all-nighters, are you resorting to stale grocery store coffee? Because it's time to switch to Sparkplug coffee. The key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans, but most Java you buy in the grocery store was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug beans are roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while it's fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers lots of varieties and grinds to suit any taste, so next time you're cruising, fuel your engine at sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi there, movie geeks, and thanks for spending a bit of your day with the Top 100 Project. We march on with our quest to review the 123 titles on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. If you don't know Wolfman Jack about American Graffiti, bail now or accept that we're going to spoil it. Oh yeah! That sounds like the Kool-Aid Man, though, doesn't it? Anyway, I am Ryan Ellis in the driver's seat with that bitchin' babe riding shotgun. My wife Bev.
That's me.
And our dog Fox is in the back seat playing with toys and being annoying.
Panting away.
The coming attractions trivia, and this was a doozy. Francis Ford Coppola produced American Graffiti after previously directing The Godfather. What five other directors of AFI movies also produced at least one other AFIer without also directing it?
Spielberg?
No.
Damn it!
Are you out already?
I'm out!
One guess is all you get.
All right.
You're going to recognize the names, but most of them are not actually all that famous. Marion C. Cooper directed King Kong,
along with
Ernest Schoedsack, and then later produced The Searchers for John Ford. Joseph L. Mankiewicz, he directed All About Eve, and he had previously produced The Philadelphia Story for George Cukor. Stanley Kramer directed Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and he'd previously produced High Noon for Fred Zinnemann. Alan J. Pakula, a lot of initials in this trivia. He directed All the President's Men and Sophie's Choice after producing To Kill a Mockingbird for Robert Mulligan. And the final one is actually the director of the film we're going to talk about today, George Lucas, because he directed and wrote and many other things, Star Wars and American Graffiti.
Oh.
And he produced
Indiana Jones.
Raiders of the Lost Ark
for
Steven Spielberg.
I'm really glad that I gave up on that early because I think that's one of the hardest ones you've ever given.
Yeah, it takes some work one night. You got to know your AFI movies, you got to know your directors and your producers. If anyone got that, I'd be impressed. So anyway, movie number 86 in the Top 100 Project, American Graffiti, was 77th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 between City Lights and Rocky. Then it motored up to 62nd in 2007 between newcomers Sullivan's Travels, not one of your favorites, and Cabaret, not one of my favorites. Universal Pictures premiered American Graffiti in the dead of summer on August 1st, 1973. Then they tossed it out there on August 11th for everyone to see, and they were rewarded with a stupendous hit. The small-budget flick grossed many millions. And Bev will describe that small-budget flick that made many millions with the skinny.
Teenagers enjoy one last summer night cruising around a small California town before two of them head off to college. The college-bound guys are Kurt, played by Richard Dreyfuss, and Steve, played by Ronnie Howard. Steve is having trouble breaking up with his girlfriend Lori, played by Cindy Williams, while Kurt obsesses over a mysterious blonde he spots in a T-Bird. Paul LaMatte and Charles Martin Smith have their own goofy cruising adventures.
Or in a nutshell, young punks pollute the air and waste fuel with exorbitant motoring. These guys are not green. Jerks. All right, 95% of critics. Very strong score, 41 fresh reviews, 2 rotten on Rotten Tomatoes, and 84% of audiences. And also, here's the more impressive number, 44th on Box Office Mojo's Adjusted for Inflation list, ahead of Batman and all the Lord of the Rings movies, when you do adjust for inflation. And it was third at the 1973 U.S. box office behind The Exorcist and The Sting, which were number 1 and number 2, although they didn't make this list.
It made a lot of its money in a reissue, right? And it did very well in foreign markets as well.
And it also did very well when it first was released.
Oh,
against the beliefs of Universal Pictures. They had no faith in this movie, even when it was done, and they saw a cut of it. They still didn't have faith in it.
Even though it became kind of like a viral hit among Universal Studios employees.
Mm.
And there was a bidding war for it. People were trying to buy this film out from Universal because they were so wishy-washy about releasing it. Coppola tried to buy it back, and some other studios tried to buy it. They all believed in this film, but Universal was like, maybe we'll cut a pile of scenes. They did cut a pile of scenes out. They almost released it as a TV movie.
But I just love that story, that this movie was finished. Mm. And they still didn't have faith in it. And the kids did love it. As you said, studio employees, you saw it. But no, that's not a fair indication. That's, what are you talking about? That's an audience.
Well.
All right, well, anyway. You were not a big fan of this movie, and tell everyone why.
I really want to like this movie far more than I ultimately do. I saw it when I was younger and wasn't really crazy about it then either. I think it's well made, it's entertaining, it's gutsy and unique, and it's super authentic in a way that's still rare for films about teenagers especially. It's aged really, really well. There's so much to love about it, and I respect it, but I do not care for it. I think its fatal flaw for me is that I just don't find any of the four main characters at all relatable or likable. Particularly Dreyfus, who I have had a lifelong hate on for. I don't know why. He just makes my skin crawl.
Okay, let's get into Dreyfus details later on, because he is the first billed actor in this movie, and if there is a star, it is him. Although I suppose the characters are kind of equally placed in the movie, and they are given about the same amount of screen time. The relatable thing, you've said this about a few movies that admittedly are guy-centric. Most movies are, most AFI movies certainly are. That's been a theme in this podcast from the beginning, just like racism has been a theme in this podcast. But why are these characters not relatable? You're twice their age, and because they're boys. But
you
other
know,
than
it's
that,
they should be relatable on many levels, and it's silly because even as I said it, I think, yeah, but I loved Last Picture Show, and those guys are even less relatable.
Yeah.
And something that I really admire about American Graffiti is how real the characters seem, and particularly the female characters, even though they're definitely secondary characters, at least they're legitimate humans. They're not Mary Baileys or just like archetype people. They're each different. They have individual personalities that really come through. And that's actually really refreshing. So maybe it's less the relatability factor. And like we say all the time, a good movie will make you able to relate to a cockroach if they do it right. And so...
You do agree with me on that one. I've said that for a long time.
Yeah, I kind of take that back. It's not the relatability factor. I grew up in a fairly affluent suburb. I went to college. I probably had a night very similar to that night before I went away to university. So there is lots of these things that I should be able to relate to. There's lots of things that probably remind me of my own teenagehood. I think it's more the unlikability.
Okay, so why are they not likable? How do you not like Toad? Charles Martin Smith steals every scene that he's in this movie.
I guess. I don't know. He kind of annoys me. He's a liar. It's such a cliche thing. The guy lies to a girl through the entire film and then she likes him anyways, even though she's way out of his league. Maybe it wasn't a cliche back then, but... God, it's just been done to death, and it's so hard to believe that something like that would ever happen to a loser. Loser, I know it sounds harsh, but he is. There's a reason why he's not successful with girls. He's super awkward and weird and not particularly attractive.
All right, fair enough. Maybe they did that for the sake of the comedy.
And maybe they just wanted to cast him because he's really good in it. Not that I had a problem with Candy Clark, actually. I thought she was great, but maybe they just had to cast two actors that were more similar in looks. She's just so much more attractive than him that it was very hard to believe.
I got recently watching clips from Knocked Up. I didn't watch the movie itself. The biggest criticism for that movie was that Katherine Heigl is thousands of yards away from Seth Rogen. And yet they made a lot of people, it was a big hit, believe that he could land her.
So do you believe that Terry could land Debbie?
I don't dwell on that stuff. I don't know why, because if I was Toad, and I'm probably closer to Toad than I am to the other guys, really. I certainly wasn't Steve. Well, you didn't know me as a teenager. I didn't really truly fit into any one group. I was smart, but I wasn't a nerd. I was athletic, but I wasn't truly a jock. I wasn't a freak like in Freaks and Geeks by any means. I wasn't a druggie or those kinds of things. But I could relate to almost every group, but I was never really in one group. So if I had to pick one character instantly I liked the most from this group, or the one I'd want to hang out with the most, if I could go into 1962 when this film is set, it would be Terry the Toad. Maybe because he's funny, right from the very beginning with that Vespa accident, which was not scripted.
No, I know. It was a bona fide accident on the actor's part.
And it's great that Ronnie Howard and Charles Martin Smith just keep playing it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm fine. I'm fine.
So three of the main characters, everybody but Steve, Terry, John, and Kurt, are all meant to represent loosely George Lucas at different points in his life. And Terry, he said, was himself as a freshman. It's like an awkward, nerdy guy who just couldn't get anything right. Well, yeah, but then he also says that he was John at one point in his life, which I find pretty hard to believe.
Well, the drag race in particular. He said that you asked me about this. Did people actually do this in 62? Lucas says they did, so I'm going to take his word for it. That people motored around Southern California cities all night long like this and had cool cars. Even if you were Terry the Toad, you could get a great car. Yeah, he was a loner from his friend Steve. So Lucas, in that sense, could have been Milner, because he had a cool car.
Yeah, I guess so. All the gearheads that he hung out with that were super into their cars when he was growing up. And he said that Kurt was more himself when he attended USC.
Sure, the writer who goes off to do something else. That's one of the things about this movie I like. I'm sure it's very deliberate. these California boys, Steve, Ronnie Howard, doesn't go. They're supposed to be going back east to school. Using that analogy of Lucas as the writer, and that's what Kurt ends up becoming, it's reversed. Maybe you go to New York, granted, but otherwise you don't go east or Midwest or anywhere else. You go to California if you want to be a writer, if you want to try to make your name. You don't leave California. You just mentioned Milner, Paul LaMotte. He's maybe the unsung hero of this cast. He's definitely the least famous of the four of them. Charles Martin Smith has been acting forever. He's directed. We know that Ronnie Howard became a relatively well-known director, made some money, won some awards. And you may not like him, but Richard Dreyfuss has had a great career.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Paul LaMotte didn't get a lot of great things out of this movie. He was in the sequel. A lot of the people in this cast were, which is interesting because his character dies a year and a half later in a car accident.
They changed it in later versions.
More American Graffiti, the sequel?
Well, no, when they re-released the original American Graffiti, they changed the title card so that he died later.
Okay. His other big title, which is around the same time as the sequel, Melvin and Howard, where he plays Melvin Dumars in the movie about Howard Hughes.
Ah.
And Jason Robards, Mary Steenburgen won an Oscar for that film. He was also later in American History X. This was his first movie, though, and he's really assured for a new actor. He's obviously also the inspiration for Wooderson in Dazed and Confused, which this movie certainly inspired.
Oh, yeah, big time. He's probably my favorite arc of the four guys. Maybe because it's just more pleasant to watch somebody go from being a tough to showing his sweet side and just the whole story with him. With Mackenzie Phillips, yeah. I really like her and the two of them together.
This is her first film, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone knows her, if anything, it would be from One Day at a Time. She mostly did do TV after this movie. She's pretty cute and funny in this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the many examples of Lucas deliberately keeping in errors is when the water balloon hits her in the face. It wasn't supposed to. It was supposed to hit the side of the car. And her laughing, "Stop laughing!" as she's laughing.
Yeah.
Well, it was funny to her that it hit her right in the face. And he kept that in there because he thought that was a good little moment. Although, as I pointed out to you during the movie, the punishment doesn't really fit the crime when they spray shaving cream all over the girl's car who throw that water balloon and then pop the air to their tires.
Yeah.
Getting a little wet.
A little overkill.
Minor compared to what they do to them. There are other mistakes they kept in the movie, though, too. One of my favorite scenes is certainly the liquor store scene where Toad and Debbie go for the old Harper. Trivia question for you. He gets five other items to disguise the old Harper. What are those other items?
I only remember the comb, maybe some cigarettes.
No, comb is correct, cigarettes is not.
What were they?
I'll get a Three Musketeers, a ballpoint pen, a comb, some flashlight batteries, beef jerky, and in there is the old Harper.
Flashlight batteries is what killed me in that scene.
Nice homage in The Simpsons. Yeah. Homage almost every movie we've done so far, and that's one of them. That's where Homer disguises the illegal fireworks.
I don't know what you've got planned tonight, Homer, but count me out!
So anyway, the mistake in that scene, actually there's two of them. The first one is when the guy who robs the liquor store and actually is enough of a stand-up guy to get that liquor for them, he throws it and Smith was looking away and he barely looked back in time to catch it as it almost hits the ground. And the other mistake in that scene is before he gets the booze, he comes back with those other things, the Three Musketeers, the comb and all that stuff. And Candy Clark is, she stammers. Did you get it? Did you get it? And she's in the documentary on the Blu-ray and the DVD talking about how she hates that he kept it in there. But he was going for that real life thing. And there's a bit of a sidebar on this. Lucas, everyone's criticized him 1,000 times over. I won't do that too much. We'll save that for Star Wars. But in the Star Wars series, in Phantom Menace, there's a scene in that where Jar Jar Binks, everyone hates Jar Jar Binks, when they're going off for their big adventure about 2/3 of the way through the movie, he's camera right, I guess it would be, and he's gesturing towards the plane, "Misa, get on the plane now," or whatever the hell he says. And for a minute, he kind of disappears off the frame and comes back in. And Lucas said in the commentary about how he wanted that to seem like it was an accident. That thing was digital. It can't be an accident. It's not possible. But here's an example of where he kept in people messing up, giving it reality.
Yeah, he really wanted a documentary style. Mm-hmm. It works well for this film. I mean, it's something that's been copied many times over. I think it really adds to the charm and what makes it so unique, especially at the time.
You said documentary realism. The movie was shot quickly, mostly at night.
Mm-hmm.
28 nights in total. And this movie is a night in the life rather than a day in the life. Yeah. And it's about 12 hours. It starts at dusk, goes till dawn when the drag race happens. There's another trivia question for you. Every one of the main characters has a female love interest, although I guess Dreyfuss is debatably imaginary, incidentally.
I don't know how debatable it is. Lucas has said himself that they wanted to shoot a scene that would have made it explicit that she was imaginary.
That Susan Somers and the T-Bird is not actually something that anyone no one else ever sees her except for him.
Yeah, and they wanted to shoot an opening scene where she's driving around a drive-in by herself, but she's transparent.
Oh, okay.
And that was supposed to make it evident that she's always this perfect imaginary creature. Even when he gets the phone call, he's the only one there. And the silliness of him seeing that car from the plane, almost like, remember in Giant, where they wave at somebody in a plane and they wave back? And no, that's not how it works.
That opening scene would have been cute, but I'm glad they didn't do that.
They couldn't afford to. They didn't have it in the budget.
But they didn't need to hit that on the head.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true.
Because he's idealizing something. He's trying to find an excuse to stay, and that's not enough of an excuse to stay. Mm-hmm. The trivia question, though, for you is, of the four lady love interests for the four characters, how many of them are present at the climactic drag race?
Just Lori, right? Mm-hmm.
Carol's gone home.
He takes a kid home, and Debbie and Toad's not there either, is he?
Yeah, he is.
He is? So what happened?
He does the girl's job, usually in movies like this.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Where he's signaling them to start the race.
Yeah.
He becomes Milner's date, in effect, because their two women are gone. They've both gone home by that point. I don't know if this was the first movie to do it. It probably wasn't, but it certainly did popularize it. And Lucas did it to an extent in Star Wars. The episodic cross-cutting with the four main characters often intersecting with each other. There's a shot at one point where I think it's Steve's car, but Toad is got it, is driving by. Maybe Steve is actually in it. And then Milner turns a corner. They don't see each other, but it's almost like we go from one of the stories to another one right then and there in a shot. Do you, as a professional editor, think that worked?
Yeah, I think actually editing is one of the strengths of this film. It's really challenging to do four stories like that. Mm-hmm. It feels so smooth and effortless and natural. They really got it right, and they struggled really hard to get it right. The first cut of this film, they had two, kind of three editors. They started with Verna Fields.
Mm-hmm. Who cut Jaws.
Yes, she did the rough cut, and then Marcia Lucas... Mm-hmm. George Lucas's wife at the time, was the editor from then on, but their first cut was 3.5 hours because he couldn't bear losing anything, and he had this whole notion that it was going to be an ABCD story structure.
Oh, I see. So start with Steve and then only show him and then go back.
Yeah, and always do in the same order. But they had to abandon it. They had to let it go. And they struggled so much. And he got Walter Murch. He cut Apocalypse Now, also a very famous editor. He's
and sound
designer. The godfather of editing. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He helped him cut it down to 112 minutes. It was also Murch that suggested having Wolfman Jack be the thread that carried it all through.
MASH, yes. And all those announcements, so what carried that one through? Mm-hmm. Both of them with voiceovers, and also movies that use rock and roll. And Easy Rider did that, I guess, first and foremost on our project so far. But now we've got movies that have come since that have used it also very well. And Last Picture Show used diegetic music as a score rather than an actual score. There's no bona fide score in this movie. Mm-hmm. Yet again, we've said that so much the last couple of months.
And the score is such a big deal. Lucas, when he was writing the script, played all of his own record collection and wrote scenes with specific songs in mind.
Yeah.
He knew that he wouldn't be able to necessarily license all of them because licensing was a lot in this movie. Mm-hmm. So he had alternatives, but he definitely had these songs in mind.
But curious, there's no Elvis, even though it's in 62.
They couldn't license the Elvis
music.
They had to
just ignore the fact he's there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's no Beatles yet because they weren't a big band yet. Not in America, anyway.
Part of the success of this movie, part of the love of this movie, is like The Graduate, it's an example of a good film gaining tremendous esteem. Partially because it really strikes a chord with the baby boomers, who happen to be a generation that wield the most cultural influence right now. I had this thought that if only they could have managed to justify having a 100% Beatles soundtrack, then this would probably be number 5 on the AFI's top 100 list.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, I want to get back to this, Marcia Lucas and Walter Murch, and of course Verna Fields, you said. Marcia Lucas also did have an editing hand in Taxi Driver and the Star Wars trilogy. That's a great resume. Oh, she didn't really edit that many movies, nor did Verna Fields. Murch, who was primarily a sound guy, along with some editing credits, also was involved in The Godfather, Godfather Part II, and most famously to me, Apocalypse Now, with both the sound and the editing. And he did some of those same jobs in later movies like The English Patient, which won the Oscar. And I think he won awards for both the sound and the editing. The sound design works so well, and Lucas would take credit for some of this at least, if not a lot of this. Where sound effects would normally be in a movie and score, he reversed it. Because music is almost always coming out of car speakers, that in the scene where Toad and Debbie are out and the car gets stolen, there's no music, and that's how Toad knows there's something wrong. And then he hears almost horror film sound effects, and out comes Steve. I don't know how Ronnie Howard's out there and just pops out, but anyway, it's a bit of a cheap laugh, I guess, or cheap scare even.
And that's a great example of how they really incorporate music into these kids' lives. I don't know if this is a universal experience for teenagers, but I know when I was a teenager growing up 30 years after this film takes place, music was a massive part of our lives. Practically every one of us played an instrument and loved bands. And yeah, it still is. There's something about those years in your life that music, it just strikes more of a chord when you're a teenager And they really wanted that to be part of illustrating what these kids' lives were like. And that they would notice the car is missing because the music cut out. Not because they hear the car drive away. It's the music stops.
You're right, which should be more obvious. Especially some old car from the 50s, which was probably not quiet.
Yeah.
Another movie about teenagers. We've had some on the project, not a lot. Rebel Without a Cause was, I guess, maybe the first one. Last Picture Show certainly was.
Totally different thematically, but Clockwork Orange is also a movie about teenagers.
Yeah, he's supposed to be a young kid, actually, that's right. Even though he's a little older in reality than he's supposed to be. As such, there's not a lot of bad language in this movie, although I think kids would have been swearing constantly because kids always have sworn.
Yeah.
But you do hear a few A-bombs and S-bombs in this movie. Certainly no F-bombs. We've actually had a few movies in a row now where there hasn't been any swearing, despite The Godfather, for example. I think we even talked about it.
Yeah.
Where you see some naked breasts and you see an awful lot of bloody violence, but they don't ever use the F-word. They don't also use the M-word, meaning mob and mafia, in that film from 2 weeks ago. But these young teenagers, well, they weren't all young teenagers in reality, actually. But the cast were party animals during the shoot. Kind of like on Easy Rider and MASH, there was an awful lot of... Well, they didn't say in the documentary if it was pot. I'm sure some of that was going on, too. But people were always getting into trouble and partying and all that kind of stuff. Harrison Ford, his first AFI movies in 5 in total, all of which we're going to cover in the next 6 months. He's a supporting player in this film. He'll be much bigger in later movies. I think we know which ones those are. But he and Paul LaMatte at one point were kind of torturing Dreyfus and threw him in the pool at the hotel and then banged up his face.
The day before he was supposed to shoot all of his close-ups. And they lit George Lucas's motel room on fire. And they had all kinds of problems like that on set.
So Ford and LaMatte ganged up on Dreyfus. You said a few minutes ago you didn't like him. Is there something you can say to explain that, or you just don't like him?
I just find him detestable. I can't put my finger on it. I know.
So in Jaws like and Close Encounters as well.
Yes. There are several movies I couldn't get through because I just couldn't look at his face anymore.
Really?
I don't know. There's something so contemptible about him. I don't know. You like him, eh?
He's a good actor, for sure.
He's
Spielberg's...
a good actor. When he's playing somebody awful, like, say, in What About Bob, he's supposed to be a jerk. Even in Jaws,
you think it comes too naturally,
hero.
Tim? Is that what you're saying? It just comes too naturally to Dick Dreyfus.
If he's playing somebody that I'm not supposed to like, then he doesn't bother me that much. But I cannot sympathize with him as a lead actor.
Going by Hollywood lore, the opposite of him, Ronnie Howard.
Yes.
His only AFI movie in any sort of way, and it's as an actor, not as a director, which he's obviously far more known for. Everyone knows his credits, I'd say, at this point. Apollo 13 is still my favorite of all of his films. His character is probably the one you can grab onto the least. For me, it is. I can understand why Lucas doesn't relate to him as well. It's not Howard's fault. He does the job just fine, but his character is a little bit more remote. He's a prom king kind of character.
Yeah, he's Mr. Perfect. He's
got a great girlfriend. He's trying to break up with her.
He's the prom king. He's got this car.
Yeah.
There's something about that, which they obviously did on purpose, because he's driving this amazing car. He doesn't need a scholarship to go to college. Meanwhile, Kurt is driving this old beat-up Beetle.
And gets a scholarship from the Moose Club, I think it is.
Yeah, something like that. And he needs that scholarship. And so there's this real suggestion of privilege. None of the guys talk about ever having jobs or anything. And
right.
Steve gives that car up really easily to Terry without worrying about it when he finds out the car is stolen. When they're in the woods, he barely beats an eyelash.
Maybe because he's upset that he broke up with Lori and she ditched him in the woods.
Yeah, but still, I think to most teenagers, a car is actually harder to come by than a girlfriend.
Well, and he is trying to end it with her as well.
Yes.
Right. Now, everyone knows Ron Howard so well, and he's always been so likable. And he'd been Opie on Andy Griffith something like 10 years before this show.
Yeah, this was his big breakout from child acting.
So do you like him in general?
Yeah, I never watched Happy Days. I never watched the Andy Griffith Show. So I actually have very little experience with him as an actor. American Graffiti is probably my chief reference point for him as an actor.
He was good in Happy Days. Obviously, everyone knows Henry Winkler's The Fonz is by far the biggest star, but they were a good duo. Speaking of Happy Days, another influence from this movie is that the show had to have been based at least partly on this, although that's set in the 50s.
I think they straight up based his character on the character he played in American Graffiti.
He's more likable in Happy Days overall, though.
Yeah.
Both the movie and that show used Rock Around the Clock. In the beginning, at least, Happy Days later had the theme song that was called Happy Days. I love that theme song. But in the beginning, it was Rock Around the Clock. And if you look on YouTube, you'll see the opening credits, which were long and drawn out. And there's no Fonz in the version that I saw.
No way.
In the very beginning of the show. And the opening of this movie, as they show American Graffiti with that diner shot, Mel's Diner, Rock Around the Clock. And another movie, not an AFI film, but 1955, Blackboard Jungle, which is what debuted.
That's right.
I think that's where that song was first ever played. Getting back to Dreyfus' character for a minute, I've had a theory for a long time. Kind of like my theory with Roy Scheider going from French Connection to Jaws, where he's a cop who gets sick of the crap there and goes on somewhere else. Not literally that they're connected, but to me there's a connection of sorts. In this one, Dreyfus' character grows up to be the adult Will Wheaton in Stand By Me. because in that movie, Will Wheaton's character is a writer. Dreyfuss plays the older version of him, and he's writing the story that becomes Stand By Me.
So the story of Stand By Me is the story of these four guys when they were kids, maybe?
Not directly, but the character grows up to be a writer. The end card for Kurt is that he goes to Canada to be a writer.
Yeah. Well, he goes to Canada to probably dodge the draft.
I never picked up on that. Anywhere. I read on Wikipedia, I'd never seen that trivia before, that whole thing about going to Canada. I didn't really pick up on the fact that he would have gone to Canada to have been a draft dodger.
And you pointed it out to me, but it's got to be true, and they point it out everywhere.
And that's one of the things, too. The end of this movie is a really dark ending. This movie was a beloved comedy in 1973. We haven't really talked about the comedy. We'll talk about that in a second. But what a dark ending. Milner dies in a car accident. Toad is missing in action in Vietnam. Steve has got a job as an insurance agent. Probably the worst fate of the three of them, actually.
Oh, come now.
And then Kurt takes off to another country to avoid having to go to Vietnam in the first place.
Last Picture Show also has a really bleak ending, but the whole movie is kind of bleak, and they earn that dark ending. Whereas American Graffiti ends on a high, and then is like, and then they all die.
they throw cold water on your erection, so to speak.
Yeah, it's really strange. I didn't like that. And then there was criticism for that. There was also criticism for talking about the fate of the four guys, but not bothering to talk about what happened to any of the girls. Pauline Kael called it a misogynist film. I would not, because of what I said earlier about the female characters actually having character, like actually being believable human beings, which seems revolutionary still today in Hollywood, let alone in the 70s. Lucas's reason for not including the women characters was, oh, then the ending would have gone on too long. He just couldn't bear to make the movie 60 seconds longer.
Not even 60, it would have been maybe 15 seconds longer.
It's such a stupid cop-out.
Yeah. I would have been curious about Carol. She was so young. What is she going to do? Because we don't know anything about what she's going to become later on. Steve ends up marrying Lori. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
So at least we know an element of what happens to her in the future. We certainly don't know what happens to Debbie. Although she's one of the many people in the sequel, Debbie, and she becomes a much different person than what we see in 62.
Yeah, apparently the sequel is not so worth watching, though. It only has a 22% on Rotten Tomatoes. I'll let you go ahead and spoil that one for me later.
I don't remember it that well. I saw it a long time ago. Shoot. I don't remember much about it. Lucas has always crapped all over it, and apparently it's because it made no money. But that's not the reason not to like it. It's not a very good movie, according to most people.
Well, I pointed this out not long after we watched the film, and you were telling me about what a huge commercial success it was that, other than his very first film, THX 1138, every movie Lucas has made has been a tremendous, massive success.
Well, indirectly, he's been involved in some bombs like Howard the Duck.
Okay.
The co-writers of this film, Willard Hike, I think is how you say his name, and Gloria Katz, they also wrote Temple of Doom for Lucas.
Oh, which was considered the biggest, well, I don't know if you could call
it a
failure.
It's a pretty decent movie. People have raked a lot of coals on Temple of Doom, and Spielberg himself doesn't really like that movie very much. But at least it was different. As Quentin Tarantino has pointed out, if you want to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, don't bother watching Last Crusade. It's just the same movie all over again, which isn't entirely true. But at least Temple of Doom is a different adventure for Indiana Jones.
It's a more racist adventure.
Right. But getting back to the writers,
okay.
Hike and Katz, they had a hand in writing the screenplay along with Lucas. And you may not like Lucas very much, but he is a true auteur, much like Coppola as a writer, producer, director. And last week we talked about Harold Ramis doing five jobs on Groundhog Day, including writing Weatherman the Song. And Lucas was a writer, director, producer on a few of his films, most of his films.
And Lucas does not need me to like him. He's one of the most popular filmmakers in
history.
He's
also, for somebody as successful as he is, he's taken more heat than probably anybody else in pop culture, even more than Spielberg has, because for the most part, Spielberg is at least respected.
Well, I think there's lots of people that take heat, but there's few people that have levels of success that he has that take as much heat
as
he
has. A lot of it
is
jealousy, for sure. I want to go back to Kurt again. I keep bringing it back to him because you may not like Dreyfuss's character, but he is the lead, and he does carry the dramatic arc because there's not that much comedy in his story. What is the name of the gang he ends up with through so much of the movie?
Oh, what are they called? The Pharaohs?
The Pharaohs, yeah.
Yes.
Bo Hopkins, who we saw in Wild Bunch, the guy who gets left behind the opening robbery. He is the leader of the Pharaohs. But one thing about Kurt I really noticed in this viewing is that he rarely drives. This is a movie about all these guys driving all the time, including Steve. He's driving Laurie's car for the most part, and then he later on gets his own car back. Toad has Steve's car for so much of the movie and his Vespa really early on. And Milner's always driving his little yellowed coupe. But Kurt rarely drives anywhere. He's always a passenger, almost always at least, including in the plane at the end of the film.
That's a good point. I kind of assumed that it was because he was maybe a little embarrassed by his car, but it could also be a comment on how he's refusing to make decisions in his life. He doesn't want to take the wheel.
I think that's what's going on here. I think it's both those things. I think it's without driving at home. I think it's a pretty subtle little moment, actually.
He's in the back seat even for a lot of it.
Yeah, not just a passenger, but truly in the back. And he's in the back seat when he sees Suzanne Somers in that Thunderbird. The one time he does drive his car, apart from the very opening of the film when he actually gets to Mel's Diner, is to go see Wolfman Jack, which is a scene, again, not really of comedy. What is Wolfman eating when Kurt finds him?
Oh, it's candy, isn't it?
This is sweet, but it's not candy.
Oh, it's a popsicle. It's a popsicle.
Because the fridge broke. Wolfman effectively is the Wizard of Oz. He's the man behind the curtain.
Oh, yeah.
And Lucas has said that Star Wars has many Wizard of Oz elements, including the Cowardly Lion being Chewbacca and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, you've definitely got the Tin Man.
But in this movie, yeah, you've got Wolfman Jack as effectively the wizard himself. And that one little moment where we see the proof that he actually is Wolfman Jack.
I like that scene. It's a nice, warm little scene. I think it's kind of silly that he's lying about who he is, and then he sees, that's a little corny.
You mentioned
guess,
embarrassment with Kurt in his car. Maybe there's an element of embarrassment from Wolfman Jack. He's so influential on all of these kids. Everybody likes him. Everybody's, even the Pharaohs are not afraid to say, yeah, I think that guy's great. They're not trying to be cool about it. Every single person in the movie likes this guy, but he's just some nerd out there in the middle of nowhere playing a character. And Kurt decides in that moment, or if he doesn't fully decide when he actually talks to Suzanne Somers and realizes she's not really what he wanted her to be, maybe in a way. Maybe there's a part of him that wants her to not be real anymore. Because when he takes the phone call, at least tell me your name, and she won't even do that, he smiles. It's almost like he's glad that he's had that one moment. But his conversation with the Wolfman is what seems to convince him, which is, you can't stay here if you have a chance to go do something else. Get the hell out of here. And that's a trope that's been in so many things of art, not just movies, which is leaving home and going on to try to find bigger, better things, including in The Wizard of Oz. Now, we can't neglect to talk about the girls like the movie does at the very end. Cindy Williams. People may see her and think, where did that face from? Or maybe they do know, but Laverne and Shirley, by far her most famous role. But she was also in a Coppola movie the very next year, The Conversation, and actually has a very key line. If you've never seen The Conversation, you should. And once you see it, you know what I'm talking about. And she was in the sequel. Ronnie Howard wasn't in the sequel. He was obviously making movies by that point. He'd become a director. We talked about Candy Clark. Not a lot of big titles for her. Actually, all you really see on her resume that stands out is Blue Thunder and Zodiac. She's the only one of this quite good cast. A lot of younger actors. Not really any teenagers, per se, except for Mackenzie Phillips, obviously, who's really young. But she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. I guess she represented the whole cast. The Big Chill had that. Glenn Close, as good as she is, maybe not the best thing in that movie, but she's the only actor that's nominated, and she has to effectively represent the whole cast.
I just would never pick her. I would pick Dreyfuss. As much as I don't like him, he's incredibly naturalistic.
Or
I think he's a fantastic actor.
Or I go with Charlie Martin Smith in supporting.
Yeah, maybe.
And Paul Lamont is great as Mildred.
Yeah, you're right.
He did that thing that we like to mock in reality, but in movie characters maybe let slide a little bit more, which is the whole, well, things were better back in those old days. He says that line about how Rock and Roll's been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died. The old music is way better than the new music.
Well, the movie is pure, unfiltered nostalgia.
Yeah.
It really is the precipice of those good old days just about to come to an end. They talk about how Kurt wants to meet President Kennedy. Anybody who knows anything about American history knows that it wasn't long before Kennedy was assassinated.
Just over a year later.
Which is the beginning of the end for those great post-war days.
Yeah, and Vietnam was starting to ramp up at that point, but it wasn't quite happening. I just watched a Vietnam movie, which I've seen many times. I think it's very underrated. We Were Soldiers, which is about the first big battle in Vietnam. And here's a movie that takes place just before any of that really got going at all.
And, of course, the last title card is... In case you didn't pick up on any of the signs that the good old days are over... That last title card really does bring it home.
As Kurt rides off on Magic Carpet Airlines.
Yeah.
Mackenzie Phillips, though, as Carol, what did you think of her performance?
I really liked her. She was intentionally annoying and bratty, and it felt authentic. She's so gutsy, though. I don't really believe that a 13-year-old girl would get away with staying out all night. I don't believe any of them would get away with staying out all night the way they do. Maybe the guys that are about to go off to college, but all these teenage kids, I don't know how they don't have curfews. I love that her costume... What she's wearing is exactly what a 13-year-old girl would wear. She's not grown up yet, and she perfectly walks that tightrope between being a kid and a teenager in this very sweet and charming way. And when she's annoying, it's because she's supposed to be annoying, because she's supposed to be his foil all night, who he then comes around to, and I think the audience probably comes around to her, too. Isn't her dad in The Mamas and the Papas or something?
I believe John Phillips, yeah. All right, let's get behind the camera then. We don't need to dwell too much on George Lucas. Who doesn't know that name by now? He also will be directing Star Wars, and he'll be producing Raiders of the Lost Ark. We'll talk about him a bunch more before the project is over. He co-wrote the film with Gloria Katz and Willard Hike. We talked about their credits already, including Howard the Duck, which people rained fire on, and Lucas did produce that. So you may have sounded like everything he touches turns to gold. But everything he directed worked out pretty well, except for THX 1138, as far as being financially successful, and direct producer for the most part, but sometimes not so much. In an amplified, bigger way, he's kind of Christopher Nolan. That guy's gone from hit to hit to hit.
Yeah.
And huge ones at that. We said that Coppola produced the movie. We talked about that name a bunch. We're going to talk about it a bunch more. And Gary Kurtz co-produced with him. He was a producer on Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. I do like that story about how Coppola was willing to buy the film from Universal right then and there. Both Lucas and Coppola have talked about it on the documentary and in other places. behind the camera of this 2.35:1 print, a great-looking Blu-ray. Because so much of it's at night and it was not an expensive production, they made it look damn good considering that. The two cinematographers, Jan, J-A-N, so Jan Dalkin, and Ron Efeslage, I don't know if I said those names right, neither of them ever did cinematography again.
They weren't real formal DPs.
Haskell Wexler was the consultant on this film. We've mentioned this name a few times already on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, In the Heat of the Night, and he's also going to be involved in Cuckoo's Nest.
Lucas didn't really have a formal cinematographer. He kind of did it himself. Or, like, left it up to the camera guys.
With Wexler telling him how he should do things, work with lenses and all that kind of stuff, using available light the best they could.
At a time when it was harder to shoot at night than it is now. Digital, of course, changes everything, but film speeds got faster.
So did you like the look of this film? Like
Yeah, it's that documentary look. They nailed it. It looks great.
And ordinarily at this point, we get into the composer and the editor, but we already talked about them. So let's move on to the influence. We've talked a lot about that already, too. The sequel, Happy Days. It's influenced by Easy Rider with all the music and all the driving. Mm-hmm. And that movie's really influencing the 70s, as we know, of course, that it did. The movie itself was often duplicated using rock music as score and using unknown actors for A Day in the Life because there are so many people in either their first movie or one that was changing them. Ronnie Howard had been a kid actor before this, but most of them are kind of new to movies. Nobody was a star, per se. Harrison Ford was a nobody. It's hard to believe that he was ever a nobody.
He was in construction.
We said on Easy Rider that Nicholson was just about to get to that point where he's going to give up on acting and become a director and writer only. Well, Ford almost gave up on the business and became a carpenter, but then he was in this, and he's in The Conversation, which I already mentioned with Cindy Williams earlier on.
You could credit MASH and Last Picture Show with innovating, but American Graffiti was the really popular film of this style.
Perfector, as you've said
the
before.
There's the innovators and the perfectors. They definitely did the innovating, but this was the movie that blew it up, and there probably is a before and after American Graffiti that was so influential on films like this.
Well, to have been as successful as it was, 44th on Box Office Mojo.
MASH did really well, too.
Besides that, but it was... A couple of their influences, Lucas's struggles with Universal. We talked before about how they didn't like the cut when they saw it, which is hard to believe. And Warner Brothers as well, for that matter, with THX 1138, caused him to be as independent as he could be later on. And that's why he did Lucasfilm the way he did. He maybe would have played in the studio system. He maybe would have been willing, like Spielberg, to toe the company line. But he basically said, F you to these guys, and said, I'm going to start my own stuff if I possibly can. Look at all the profits he made from this movie. He made his space opera, which was the biggest hit of all time. And it isn't literally the biggest hit of all time. We know Gone with the Wind is. But when you talk about ancillary stuff, toys and all that stuff, Star Wars is gotta be the biggest media property that's ever existed. Mm-hmm. And this movie, I think, and THX to a certain extent as well, the struggles he had with the studios, he became George Lucas the mogul.
Which was a great idea until, I can't say his undoing, because he's a very wealthy and successful man, but he definitely could use a boss. He could use somebody saying no to him.
M. Night Shyamalan and maybe even Spielberg at times. Yeah. Some of these guys that can maybe get a little too big. Christopher Nolan, I've said that now, the last few movies he's made. Interstellar.
Very indulgent.
Could have used somebody to tell him, you've got good ideas here, but one more draft would work out pretty well. Mm-hmm. And the final influence, apparently David Fincher based a lot of the look of Fight Club on this film.
I just don't see it.
Did you read the same thing I did, though?
I did, but I thought about it so hard. Where is there a Paper Street House in American Graffiti? On what planet do those movies have any visual common elements?
How come Milner's not bleeding into somebody's face and cackling madly?
Where's the fur coats? How come there aren't men in fur coats and ridiculous J-Lo sunglasses?
Well, the look, we said, not the storyline. But
I don't understand what he's even talking about.
All right, not a long section of awards and lists, but here we go. 5 nominations for Oscars, no wins. Best Picture up against The Sting. Best Director, Supporting Actress for Kendi Clark. The screenplay by Lucas and Hike and Katz. And the editing, it lost most of those awards to The Sting, including, of course, Best Picture and Best Director. The movie was entered into the National Film Registry in 1995, and the only other AFI representation, 43rd on the Top 100 Laughs. And apart from Terry the Toad, who I think is funny all the time, including that accident where he backs into the guy and they go, I think we've had an accident here. Well, I won't report you this time, but next time be more careful. I think he's the funniest thing in the film by a country mile. But the movie overall isn't consistently funny. We didn't laugh out loud that much. I did more than you did.
Yeah, it's not hilarious. It definitely has lots of charming moments.
But still, 43rd is pretty high, considering they didn't find a way to get Big Lebowski and many other great comedies on that list. The only other AFI nomination it got was Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, Top 100 Songs. That's when Laurie and Steve are in the middle of their argument and get called up to dance at the big sock hop.
Oh, that was an original song?
Generally, those are original songs, but I don't think it's always original songs. Oh. Because, for example, The End in Apocalypse Now was nominated for the songs list, somehow didn't make it, but that wasn't original. So we just said the movie's kind of funny, not as hilarious as it could be. You didn't relate to the characters as much as obviously the people that love this movie did. So I'm guessing you wouldn't put it on the list, even though it went up 15 spots.
I may not like it, but I cannot deny its success, its influence, and its quality. I think it's a good film that doesn't do it for me.
We haven't watched Star Wars yet, of course, and we haven't watched Raiders yet, of course, for the project. You've seen them both before. But of those three properties, which do you think you like the best? This is the most human one. This is the one that anybody could relate to way more than a space movie and a plundering grave robber movie.
I think Star Wars. I think I would like Star Wars best out of those three.
That's the next time we're going to talk about Lucas, actually, so we got a little ways away here. And as for me, I don't know if I'd quite put this movie on the list. It is worthy from the standpoint of the things I've always talked about, why a movie should ever make a list, and if it's influential and successful, that right there puts the movie in the conversation. If I had to say, just based on what I think of the movie, forget anything that the AFI likes and the criteria and all that stuff, then no.
Yeah, my personal list, it would never make it.
No, definitely not. Okay, let's end with that then. So, coming on the heels of Godfather, the last movie we did from the project, and Groundhog Day, last week's not 100 Project film, beloved classics. This, I guess, is beloved by people, too. Not quite as beloved as those ones. Next week, we get into a movie that's beloved in a different kind of way, more from a film geek standpoint than from a populist standpoint, and it is the last bona fide film noir on the list. It's Jack Nicholson as P.I., J.J. Gittes, and Faye Dunaway as Mrs. Mulray in Roman Polanski's Chinatown.
This is one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. I love this movie.
So the coming attraction trivia for Chinatown. Who ends up dead more often in their three AFI films? Jack Nicholson or Faye Dunaway?
That is such a great question. Oh my god. That's cool. Okay, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. And if you'd like more trivia, along with lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, including links to some of the things we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What do you think of American Graffiti? Where would you put it on your Top 100 list? We would love to hear from you. Please send us a message. top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
There is a disturbing lack of graffiti in American Graffiti. There's none!
And cut.